Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon and welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council. My name is Lisa Falsko. I'm the Executive Director of the World Affairs Council, and I'd like to welcome everyone and ask you to please turn off your cell phones. We will be recording today's program for KSKA, and I'd like to thank William Toyer today for doing that recording. If you'd like to hear today's program or any of our previous programs, you can view them on the website of KSKA and listen at www.kska.org. We are delighted to offer a book today, our speaker's book. He will be talking about Victor Komrus recently published a book entitled Flawed Diplomacy, the United Nations and the War on Terror. It's available for purchase at the front, and our speaker will be signing copies after his program. We are a membership organization. If you are currently not a member, today is the day you will want to do that. We are offering a membership special so that if you sign up now, your membership will be for the remaining part of our fiscal year as well as all of next year. So lock in the prices and do that today. I would like to recognize two individuals. They don't realize that, Doug and Isolde. If you wouldn't mind coming up just for a quick moment. Doug and Isolde, if you have not met these two individuals, they are super volunteers and sightseeing specialists. They will be taking our speaker out for some sightseeing on Saturday, and the World Affairs Council would like to thank you and present a coffee card for you to come to some future programs as a thank you. If you would like to volunteer with the World Affairs Council, please come see me after our program. We have some future opportunities. On the 15th of April, we will be helping KSKA with their spring membership drive. If you'd like to join us and eat some muffins and drink coffee and answer phones, come see me and we will include you in that project. At this time, I'd like to introduce and welcome any students present. If you could please stand and be recognized, the students. Thank you very, very much for coming. It's a pleasure to see you. And thank you so much to BP for sponsoring our student lunches. They are our yearly sponsor of our entire student programs for the lunches. Speaking of students, we normally take our speakers to a local high school, and today was no exception. We brought Victor Komrus to McLaughlin Youth Center, and I wish you all could have been there. It was an amazing time. We had about between 40 and 50 students, and they were engaged and interested in his topic. He spoke to them about the evolution of Al-Qaeda and its affiliated groups. And after his hour presentation, the students didn't want to leave. And even though they had gym classes and other things to go to, about 90% of them stayed to ask more questions and glom some more information. At the end, one of the students asked if he had written a book, which he said, I actually have, and I'd like to give it to you for your library. And they cheered. It was like you had given them an extra gym class or something. They were so excited to read more about terrorism, so thank you for taking the time to thank you for taking the time to speak to our youth. At our head table, to my far left, is Mr. Rod Finkel, our immediate past president and board member emeritus. And to his right, I'd like to introduce Cheryl Myers, who will be introducing our speaker. She is our membership chair and a board member of the World Affairs Council. Cheryl.
Thank you, Lisa. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Victor Komrus. Victor has pursued a public service career in international law and diplomacy, and he is an internationally recognized expert and frequent speaker on international sanctions and the global effort to combat terrorism. His diplomatic career is extended over three decades. He led the international sanctions program on Siberia, which brought down the Milosevic regime, and he ran the U.S. sanctions efforts against the Saddam Hussein regime. He also served as the State Department's point man on sanctions related to Iran, Cuba, and North Korea, and other crisis areas. He has taught graduate courses on sanctions, diplomacy, and U.S. foreign policy at the University of Pittsburgh, where he served as the diplomat in residence. In 1994, Mr. Comrass was appointed by President Clinton to serve as the first U.S. envoy to the Republic of Macedonia. His other diplomatic assignments included postings in Africa, Europe, and Canada, and at the United Nations, the Council of Europe, and the European Union. He served as the State Department coordinator for the restitution of World War II Holocaust assets. Victor was appointed in 2002 by the UN Secretary General to serve as one of five international monitors charged with overseeing the implementation of the Security Council members against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And in 2009, he was selected to serve as a member of the U.S. Security Council's panel of experts on North Korea sanctions. He received his LLM from Harvard University in 1975 and his JD with honors from the University of Florida Law Center in 1966, where he was on the law review. He earned his BS from Georgetown University in 1964, and he is now a practicing attorney in Florida, and he also practices before the U.S. federal court. He's here today to speak to us on flawed diplomacy, the United Nations, and the war on terrorism. Please join me in welcoming Victor to our podium.
You know, there's a old Chinese benediction that goes something like, may you be blessed with peace and live in uninteresting times. Well, we certainly do not live in uninteresting times. The world is changing around us so quick that it takes our breath away. The changes that have taken place since the Second World War are incredible. They've offered great opportunities. They've offered great chances for improvement in the quality of life. They've also created opportunities for good and for evil. And I think that the world that we live in today assures that whatever happens in any part of the world can impact us, and whatever we do can have an impact almost anywhere else in the world. Terrorism is not new. Terrorism has been around probably since mankind, but it's only in these last four decades or so that terrorism has moved to the level where we can honestly say it threatens international peace and security. Terrorism in one region has become terrorism globally and affects us all. And that's why I think that it's a topic that has taken on such great import over the last 20 years. I had an opportunity after I retired from the State Department to serve for 2 years as a monitor going around the world with my four colleagues, international colleagues, to see what countries were doing to deal with terrorism and to deal particularly with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And since that experience, I've often been asked, are we winning the war on terrorism? Well, the fact of the matter is, the best that we can say is that we've held them to a stalemate. We certainly aren't winning. And if we were at any moment to let down our guard today, even for the slightest moment, we recognize that we and so many other areas of the world would be vulnerable to another terrorist attack. I put this chart up as a demonstration that terrorism continues as a great risk to us all. We've done a great job here at home. We have created, at the cost of billions of dollars, a sense of security here in the United States, and there's a sense of security in Europe. But the fact of the matter is that much of the world still experiences and suffers from international terrorism. This chart the zero represents 2001. And we can see that the number of terrorist casualties around the world continues to be substantial. Now, much of this is Afghanistan and Iraq here in brown. But if you look even at the blue and yellow areas, you'll see there is a relative constant, particularly in the blue, the rest of the world, in the terms of terrorism and the risk that it poses. So I asked myself, is this a war that can be won? Are there things that can be done to help us achieve a victory, some sense of greater security for ourselves and our children? And I'm an optimist. I think there can be. I think this is a war that can be won. But I know from my own experience, from my own observations, that in order to accomplish that, we need a much broader and more coherent international strategy to deal with terrorism. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about it, because when I worked for the UN, and I worked as one of these monitors, I got quite curious myself into what the situation was. I tried to understand why was I facing the impediments that I saw in dealing with terrorism. I tried to understand a little bit of the history. And I tried to write that in my book and tell it a little bit as a story so we can understand the precedent, what has laid the predicate for the situation that we deal with today, and what are the problems that we need to overcome. So I'm going to go back a little bit in time, if I can. For me, the date that marks the growth of a new threat of international terrorism is July 23rd, 1968. On that day, an LL flight, Flight 426, from London to Rome to Tel Aviv, was hijacked by a group from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And the plane was flown to Algiers. The passengers were let go except for 12 Israeli passengers and the Israeli crew. They were held hostage, and a demand was made that Israel release 1,200 Palestinians being held in Israeli jails. Israel had no relations with Algeria at the time. And Israel immediately went to the UN Security Council and asked for some intervention, some help. They were rebuffed. Nothing was done but a small presidential statement from the Security Council condemning the hijacking. And Israel was left on its own to seek indirect ways to negotiate for the release of these hostages. The only group, in fact, internationally, that came to their support were the Airline Pilot Association, who said that if these hostages were not released by a certain date, they would not fly on any planes to Algeria. But Israel, in the end, was forced to negotiate and to release about 100 of the terrorists that they'd had in the jails. And the sense of hijacking, blackmail was set because it worked. For the first time, the hijacking blackmail established itself as an effective tactic of international terrorism. Things got worse. Right afterwards, we saw a series of hijackings, an incredible number. The U.S. Department of the Treasury reports that between 1970 and 1986, there were 580 attempted hijackings of aircraft, of which over 280 succeeded. And what brought this hijacking issue home to us as a issue of international terrorism was what happened in September of 1970 at Dawson Field. I don't know, maybe some of you remember that occasion when Palestinian terrorist groups ended up attempting to hijack 5 aircraft and flew 3 of them to Dawson Field in Jordan. And one of them went to Cairo. The attempt on the LAL flight at that time did not succeed. In fact, LAL stopped three of the terrorists from boarding the LAL aircraft. They turned around and boarded instead a Pan Am flight, which they then hijacked to Dawson Field. And at that time, they took the passengers off the plane. They blew the planes up, and they held the hostages for ransom again for the release of terrorists, and the international community got all excited. Still, the UN did little more than provide a condemnation resolution with no particular action. And in my mind, set the stage for my title of this book, Flawed Diplomacy, because the United States, rather than continue to apply the pressure necessary to achieve a more positive political result, decided that we should use our efforts in a technical and legal fashion and take these matters instead to the International Civil Aviation Organization and put in place a series of paper conventions that would outlaw such activity. And the conventions that resulted from this basically said that that these are crimes and that each country should either prosecute those engaged in these crimes or they should extradite to some other country. And we'll talk about that principle a little bit later and how it came back to haunt us. By this time, by the 1970s, hijacking was a very well-established process, and I think it leads directly to what happened on 9/11 with the terrible hijacking of our aircraft. Anyway, already set in place was a precedent of the United Nations being unwilling or unable to deal with terrorism as an international issue. But the world's attention was again focused on these issues of terrorism quite dramatically in August of 1972 at the Munich Olympics, when another group of terrorists came in and in the end caused the death of 11 Israeli athletes in what was a tragic incident that took place both at the Olympic Village and at the Munich airport. The attention of the international community was again grabbed, and there was enormous pressure put upon the Secretary General, Kurt Waldheim, to lay the issue before the General Assembly and to seek a resolution from the General Assembly that would deal with terrorism. That resolution was drafted by an ex-American congressman who was serving as the Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, who took these issues very seriously, a guy by the name of Bradford Morse. And Bradford Morse came up with a resolution that would very clearly deal with the issues of what was needed to strike back at terrorism, measures to prevent terrorism. The Arab League went wild. Ambassador Baroudi, who was then their leading spokesman from Saudi Arabia in the General Assembly, warned Kurt Waldheim that if this resolution stood as it was, they would lose their support for any re-election in the General Assembly, from the General Assembly as Secretary General. And in committee, what was a very strong resolution condemning terrorism was turned on its head. And what came out was very different. And a good part of that resolution, which is one of the longest named resolutions that ever was passed by the General Assembly, are these words, that it called for the study of the underlying causes of terrorism and acts of violence which lie in misery, frustration, grievance, and despair, and which cause some people to sacrifice human lives, including their own, in an attempt to effect radical changes. what was done was that there was a justification for terrorism. And terrorism was blamed on colonialism, racism, and Zionism. That was the cause for terrorism, it was said, and those were the root causes, and that's what needed to be addressed, not measures against the terrorists themselves. We were stuck internationally with that mantra, with that set mindset in the United Nations until the 1990s. I think we all recall what happened in December 28th, 1988, when Pan Am Flight 103 was bombed. The world was changing by that time. 1988 was already a time when the Soviet Union was going through its own great problems and changes. Gorbachev had established a policy of perestroika. There were new opportunities with Russia to deal with some of these problems. And following the bombing itself, it took us some time to trace the responsibility back to Libya. And by 1991, it was very clear that the Libyans were responsible for this act, a state-sponsored act of terrorism. Another change was taking place also that was dramatically altering the landscape. And that was the Oslo Accords were secretly being pursued, and a new opportunity for dealings between the Israelis and the Palestinians had been created with the PLO. So finally, an atmosphere was in place that would allow for some condemnations and something more than condemnations, that is, the use of sanctions measures to impose a cost, a consequence, on states supporting terrorism. And for the first time in the UN's history, finally in 1991, a resolution was passed by the Security Council imposing sanctions on Libya for its actions. And similar actions were later taken in the case of Sudan in another context. The world was changing in another fashion, too. 1988, the Soviet Union, Russia announced that it was finally withdrawing from Afghanistan. A war had been going on for 9 years and 50 days in Afghanistan, a war that had galvanized Islamic community around the world with U.S. and Western support to defeat the Soviet Union and its thrust southward into a region that was strategically very important to us all. And inside Afghanistan, a new group was taking form, a group which we later identified as Al-Qaeda under the leadership of Mr. bin Laden and others. The world was changing. Other developments were occurring. Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. The Saudis, greatly concerned about the risks posed to them by Iraq, had invited American soldiers to come to Saudi Arabia, something that a number of the great radical fundamentalist Islamists felt was wrong, that having Christians, crusaders, in their holy land was something that they would not put up with. And so a new group came about, which has its own very unique but very striking history, Al-Qaeda. And it declared war on the United States. Now, there were several times which, when Al-Qaeda attacked us, and we didn't even know it was Al-Qaeda at the time. The Khobar Towers, the first attempt to bring to bomb the parking spaces of the Twin Towers in New York, the Black Hawk Down in Somalia, an attack that took place as well at a hotel in Aden, which was directed against Marines, but they were absent at the time and it only killed some Australians. But it came home to us very clearly on August 17, 1998, when Al-Qaeda planned and sponsored attacks against our embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and in Tanzania. And turned our attention to Al-Qaeda as a terrorist organization. We began to demand that the Afghan government, then controlled by the Taliban, turn him over to us, but with little success. Then, again in October 12, 2000, many of you remember the incident of the USS Cole, which a small boat alongside blew up, killing a number of American sailors. And again, it was directly traced back to Al-Qaeda. And then none of us can forget September 11th, which truly changed the international commitment and our own commitment to deal with terrorism as a grave threat to international peace and security. These are the guys. These are the guys that put Al-Qaeda together. Mr. bin Laden, who was 25 years old when he went to Afghanistan and joined up with Mr. Azam. Get the name, let's see if we can get the name. There they are. Mr. Azam, who had been his mentor at the university in Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden was supposed to study economics. He was supposed to enter his father's business, a construction business. But he was very taken with this very strict Wahhabi theology. And at the same time also, he was greatly influenced by Mr. Azam, who was a student of Sayyid Qutb and the Muslim Brotherhood idea of the reestablishment of a great international Islamic caliphate based upon Sharia law. Subsequently, anyway, bin Laden followed Azam to Peshawar in Pakistan, and the two of them worked together to help recruit soldiers, mujahideen, for the war against Afghanistan. They were joined subsequently by Dr. Amman Zawahiri, who was involved in the assassination of Anwar Sadat, and when he was released from prison in Egypt, went first to Saudi Arabia and then to join these others in Pakistan. And at the end of the war with the Soviet Union, with Russia in Afghanistan, the three of them put together a new organization known as Al-Qaeda. And during the period that they were in Afghanistan during this war, there were several thousand Afghan Arabs. Really, they were people that were coming from all over the Islamic world to participate in the fight against the Soviet Union, who were recruited and indoctrinated in this new idea of a world caliphate and jihad, and went around, went back to their countries with very close links to this new organization. Also created during this period of time was a very broad financial network to support this Al-Qaeda organization, drawing upon funds from a number of different sources, including from Mr. Nada and Mr. Nasruddin, who served as the principal bankers of the Muslim Brotherhood, and from some very important deep pockets in Saudi Arabia, such as Yasin Al-Qadi, a Saudi billionaire who was very sympathetic to their cause, and from a number of charities, and Mr. Al-Aqil was the head of an international charity known as Al-Haraman that was clearly infiltrated by Al-Qaeda during this period of time. After 9/11, the UN was galvanized to deal with terrorism, and it used the tools at its disposal, resolutions and conventions outlawing terrorism and terrorism financing. The first resolution to be passed was a very major accomplishment for us, because the resolution itself stands as a great and strong statement concerning terrorism and clearly outlaws terrorism and terrorism financing. And under Chapter 7, puts obligations. It's created new international law in the area of terrorism. It states that All states shall ensure that any person who participates in the financing, planning, preparation, or perpetration of terrorist acts has to be brought to justice, and that such terrorist acts are serious criminal offenses in domestic laws and regulations, and they must be punished. The Department of State was quite happy with this resolution. It was something of a surprise that they were able so quickly to pass it in the Security Council, and it showed a new coherence and a new sense of common feelings about terrorism in the international community. And after it was passed, the State Department put out a checklist which of the things, the facts that they thought should come from this resolution. And I think today it still serves as a checklist to see what has been done and what has not been done in the fight against terrorism. Steps are to be taken by all countries to prevent the commission of terrorist acts, to deny safe haven to terrorists and their supporters, to interdict terrorist activities on their soil, to prosecute and punish terrorists, to cooperate one with the other in the criminal proceedings against the terrorists, to improve their own effective controls to stop the movement of terrorists, the mobility of the terrorist groups, to suppress the recruitment of terrorists, to cut off the funds, the weapons, and explosives that are flowing to the terrorists, to criminalize the funding of terrorism, and to freeze the assets of the terrorists and their supporters. Unfortunately, our success in many of these areas has not been very great. That resolution stands as a major principle now, a major obligation in international law when it comes to terrorism. But it suffers from two critical flaws that have undermined its utility and made it much less useful than might have otherwise been the case. First of all, in order for its terms to come into effect, there has to be a terrorist act or plans of a terrorist act. It is not preventive, it is reactive. And what we really need in dealing with terrorism is prevention. Get them before they perpetrate an act of terrorism, not simply punish them after. And as serious or even more serious than that flaw was the fact that no one ever defined what they meant by terrorism. We lack still today a clear definition of terrorism, and we left it to, it's left to each country to determine for itself who the terrorists are. So Saudi Arabia today says Hamas is not terrorists, they're freedom fighters. Iran says the same thing about Hezbollah. These are terrorist organizations. They employ terrorist tactics, but nevertheless, these countries continue, and other countries in the Gulf and elsewhere, continue to fund Hamas, Hezbollah, and a great number of other terrorist organizations simply because they have deemed them as something other than terrorist organizations. A very serious flaw. With respect to Al-Qaeda, certain other measures were imposed. Oops, did we miss that one? I guess there's another slide that may have gotten, there it is. 1267, a resolution that was directed against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban specifically. We weren't going to allow this notion that there was, it's up to each state to decide for itself who the terrorists are. We made it a lot clearer with respect to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. They were terrorists. The UN said so. They were identified. There couldn't be any wiggle room. But who was a member of Al-Qaeda and who was a member of the Taliban? Who should these measures apply to? And that's the fatal flaw in this particular very strong resolution. This resolution directed that in order for its terms to apply, there had to be a designation. The UN Security Council, through a special committee established by the Security Council, called the Al-Qaeda and Taliban Sanctions Committee, would go about and designate who were the members of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And that designation would then be required that all states freeze the assets of these individuals, that it stop their mobility and prevent them from traveling, and that it certainly keep from them any funds or any explosives or weapons. Very clear requirements, very much imposed. And initially, the committee put together a list of a couple of hundred people and entities who were identified as associated members of Al-Qaeda, including those principally responsible for the funding of Al-Qaeda. That list has changed very little since 2002. Take the Taliban, for example. The list on the Taliban today is 10 persons shorter than it was in 2002. There have been two additions and a couple of subtractions. It's still a number of the people on the list are no longer with us. They have passed it to another world. The lists, both for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, are so out of date that 1267 has become almost useless in preventing these activities from taking place, because states have become, for a series of other reasons, very hesitant and reluctant to designate. And those lists are terribly out of date. The resolution also created, in 2002, a special monitoring group. That was the monitoring group which I was appointed to serve on. And it was a very unique monitoring group in the UN context. We were given a full, free, and independent mandate to travel, to see, to report directly to the Security Council on what was happening with regard to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And we had the ability to be very specific in our reports and to name and to shame. And we did name and shame. We called to task a number of countries, including the United States, including European countries, including Saudi Arabia, Russia, and China. You can get away with that for a little while, but you can't get away with that in the UN for very long. And so 2 years later, when our mandate expired in January of 2004, our group lost its mandate and we all went home. This is a trip taken right to the border of Iran and Afghanistan to look to see what was happening with respect to Iran's activities vis-a-vis Al-Qaeda at the time. The result is that today we're still stuck with a situation with terrorism that it continues to pose a threat to international peace and security. We've lost the ability to monitor and to hold countries responsible, and the international framework is outdated and not as effective as it has to be against the threats that are posed. As I mentioned earlier, we continue to have a lack of a definition of terrorism. For over 10 years, the General Assembly has debated a comprehensive convention for the prevention of terrorism and had been unable to reach any consensus on a definition of terrorism, in large part because of the Conference of the Islamic Organizations, Organization of the Islamic Conference, I'm getting that backwards, has resisted many of the terms, wanting to keep a free hand to provide support for those groups that they continue to favor, such as Hamas and such as Hezbollah. So there's, as a result, no real consensus on who the terrorists are. There's no real consensus except that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are terrorist organizations, but still there's no clear list of who is involved or which organizations are involved in support Al-Qaeda and the Taliban beyond that outdated, consolidated list maintained by the United Nations. And as a result, it's quite an ineffective application of these important counterterrorism measures that are obligations on all countries. So, as a result, we can still see in many ways that indoctrination and recruitment of terrorism continues to be a problem, and that they certainly have no shortage of arms, explosives, the recruits, and even funding. A very troubling report from the CIA last year indicated that over $105 million was provided to the Taliban from external sources. This is above and beyond the money that they earn from the local drug trade, coming largely from the Gulf countries and solicited internationally in support of the Taliban. Those are funds that are being used to fight our soldiers in Afghanistan. So, what can we say about the strategy? Well, there's another strategy out there. There's another group of countries, including our own, including the European countries and certain other countries, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and others, that have kind of begun to work on their own together to deal with terrorism and to put in place an effective preventive security system that allows us to cooperate and work together to stop the terrorists from hitting at our homelands. And we have within that group been very effective in maintaining and strengthening an international framework for criminalizing terrorism and for cooperating and sharing information. The information channels between us and the European countries are excellent today, and I think that is one of the great reasons that we have more generally been free from any major terrorist attacks now for several years, knock on wood. We've also worked together to take offensive action against the terrorists in Afghanistan and in Yemen and in Iraq and in other areas. We've had a number of successes, and these are very important. We have been very effective at the detection and disruption of terrorist cells in our countries. We've been very effective in arresting those involved in terrorism here at home. We have frozen a great number of assets, and we've cut off Europe and the United States pretty effectively as a funding source for terrorism. There's still a lot left in the rest of the world, I can assure you. We have identified a number of the key financiers of terrorism and taken actions to freeze their assets. We have about $137 million worth of frozen assets in our countries. We have closed down Al-Qaeda banking networks. We forced them to use alternative financing methods and transfer methods, such as the informal transfer systems known as Hawala or as couriers or cash transfers. We've changed the whole nature of the international banking community with rules of compliance now that in which they must invest the billions of dollars themselves in assuring that they comply with laws that require them to know their customer and to do due diligence and hold them to a very high standard of accountability if they engage in any kind of terrorism financing or money laundering issues and several other financial issues related to criminal activity. That's changed quite a bit over the last number of years. We have a regular pattern now of the international financial institutions reporting suspicious transactions to our authorities, which help us to stop these transfers from taking place and to trace them back both to the originators of the transfers and to the cells that might carry out the terrorist activities. We've established financial intelligence units that can carry forth this exercise in a very effective manner, and we have a very excellent system within our groups of countries to deal with an exchange of information. But the rest of the world has been left to fend for itself. And until we can bring the rest of the world into this process, and we can all have those same kinds of effective measures together, the terrorists are going to continue to be able to operate from their bases in those areas in the rest of the world, and to challenge us and keep us on our guard and affect our interests overseas. If a bomb goes off in Mumbai, it affects us all. If a bomb goes off in Bali, it affects us all. It's this area of cooperation has to be extended and secured. Now, the UN is very cognizant that it needs to do much more, and before leaving the UN, Kofi Annan tried to put forth a new strategy. He called it his D-word strategy. I think D is good because it was largely defensive as a strategy. And he called on the international community to take further measures to dissuade disaffected groups from choosing terrorism as a tactic to achieve their goal, to deny terrorists the means to carry out their attacks, to deter states from supporting terrorism, to develop a capacity to prevent terrorism, and in all of this to make sure that we still preserve human and civil rights. I think that these are all great measures. But I, at least it's, I come to the end of my analysis of what's needed, and as I discuss in much more detail in the book, I would like to move to a little bit more aggressive strategy. I call it my C word strategy. Accountability, you got to look at the second letter. Commitment. I think we've got the commitment of most countries. We still must press for the commitment of all countries politically to deal with terrorism as a international issue, to carry out their responsibilities. And if we get the other parts of this, I think we will get the commitment. Clarity. We still need to be more clear as to who are the terrorists. What is terrorism? I have a very simple approach. If you engage in tactics that are terrorist, and we know what they are, when you put a bomb on a bus, when you blow up an aircraft, when you bomb a shopping center, when you go after indiscriminately victims without any purpose other than to indiscriminately target victims, target the innocent, then that's terrorism. It can't be anything else. No matter what the justification, no matter what your objective and its laudability, when you employ terrorist tactics, you are involved in terrorism. You are a terrorist. And I think that we need to put that clarity forth in a clear international obligation and convention for all states. You can have clarity and you can have commitment, but a number of countries still lack the capacity, the ability to deal with terrorism within their own frontiers and to deal with terrorism financing. So I think we need to do much more than we've done to date to help build the capacity of all countries that are willing to engage in this counterterrorism strategy. As I said earlier in my talk, we need cooperation. We have great cooperation among a defined number of countries. That needs to be expanded much more broadly to cover many more areas of the world. We need accountability. I believe accountability, the first step in accountability is transparency. I think the United States government made a great mistake when it allowed the mandate of the monitoring group to expire and replaced it with a group that is incapable of carrying out that same mission. The successor group to our monitoring group was limited in its resolution specifically to studying the reports provided by governments with respect to their counterterrorism strategies. The group could only travel to a country after it had been invited by the country. It had to tell the country what it was going to do and who it was going to speak to. And when it came back, the group has to discuss all of its findings and who they spoke with the government concerned before they can put it in a report. Every member of that team was cut off from the confidential sources and the sensitive sources. He could only, in the end, receive the dog and pony shows that were being presented to him by the governments. Now, that group has done some good work systemically, that it has looked at a number of the basic kinds of problems related in keeping information up to date on those on the consolidated list, on taking off people from the consolidated list when they die. It's done a lot of very positive things in terms of establishing criteria for determining who should or should not be on the list generically, but not who should or should not be on the list specifically. And it has not dealt with any compliance issues or held any or named any country or criticized any country since it began its operation in 2004. That's not a system of accountability. We need a system of accountability and transparency where we can have a group of monitors, whether it be under the UN auspices or independent auspices, that can keep the world informed about what's going on in a non-confidential manner that doesn't implicate any government specifically, because it is a group of independent experts, as we were, that could report on what was actually happening without causing any diplomatic or political baggage for any specific country charging another country in that regard. Very important that we create a new monitoring capability. And finally, there has to be consequences. There has to be some consequences with respect to those states who do not respect these principles, who continue to provide safe haven and support and finances for terrorism, for state-supported terrorism. There's no place for that in this world today. I remember talking to one group, talking on the radio, and I was always taken by this one specific reaction. The guy called in and he said, "Those financing the terrorists are just getting away with murder." And that's really just a simple, straightforward fact. That's what they're getting away with. I'd be glad to take any questions. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much. Obviously, there's a lot to think about in your book, but the one takeaway that I had from it was at a somewhat different level than terrorism itself, and that is whether the UN as an institution really has grown so big and includes so many diverse interests, as we were talking about, that it continually neutralizes itself and thus is ineffective in anything other than, say, cultural or humanitarian or education efforts, forcing countries like ours and others to operate outside of the UN in order to get anything done. You, as a former affiliate or someone working close to the UN, would you have a comment on that?
I think the UN is an essential organization. It is the one place where we all come down together. It's the place that gives us the legal and authority to act in many regards. It's not the end all. And we should not think of it as the end all, that if the UN fails to act, there's no other ways to act. In many cases, we have acted outside of the UN structure. When it comes to terrorism, which is a global issue, which can only be defeated on a global basis, because even if it exists in only a few countries overseas and can affect our interests from those countries, it's a problem for us. There is no other organization but the United Nations that can lay the foundation, I think, for an effective response. But it has failed terribly in doing that. Now, whether we can get it to do that or not, I don't know. I had hoped that might be the case. I called this book Flawed Diplomacy because I felt, as I read through and learned about more of the history, that it was not only flawed diplomacy on the part of the United States, but on the part of the Soviet Union as well, who had the same basic interest that we did from the beginning in dealing with terrorism. God knows the Soviet Union, Russia today, has suffered from terrorism as much as any country. I think the Third World itself, the countries that supported the G77 and led them, such as India, made grave and flawed mistakes in their policies on these regards, allowing a justification for terrorism that came back to haunt them, because they are also a great victim of terrorism today. And terrorism is also a problem for Egypt and for Saudi Arabia and for Yemen and for so many countries. And it was their recognition, their thought, that somehow terrorist groups are okay so long as they're doing it to somebody else, that has come back to haunt so many of them. a flawed diplomacy on all of their parts. So I still think that the UN is the essential organization where these things have to happen, but I recognize that that we certainly have to count on alternatives as well. Who's calling? Are you going to? Okay.
Okay. All right.
Fine.
I want to follow up on one what my previous questioner had touched upon, and that's education. I understand that in order for any terrorist or terrorist group to operate, they have to have the grassroots support. And I think I haven't heard anything in your talk that there is an education, an alternative program which can be presented to these people to take away that support. Is there anything in the UN which addresses it?
Yes. There should be, and I hope in my book there is some discussion of that. The notion that Kofi Annan put together in his strategy of dissuading is in part an educational process that we do need to deal with and counter a lot of the indoctrination that is taking place. That is a very difficult effort. We come very late to it. There was a suggestion, or is a suggestion, that the terrorists are motivated, as that resolution in 1972 said, from the misery, etc. But when you look at those guys that flew the planes against the Twin Towers, these weren't people that were in misery. These were well-educated, well-financed individuals coming from a very different group in society. There might have been a time and place when terrorism was more motivated by some of these concepts. There were groups of anarchists who found support among those that were in misery, etc. But that doesn't seem to be what we're facing today with Hamas or Hezbollah or with Al-Qaeda, the Taliban. They are not motivated by their misery. They are motivated by a belief, extreme as it is, that they are doing God's work. And that's a very difficult concept to counter. But it's one that we must. And I think the most responsibility for that effort has to come from the come from and within the Islamic community itself, which I think is doing an increasingly good job in countering that notion of Islam by demonstrating that Islam is basically a religion of peace, not of jihad and of violence.
I guess our friend here is deciding who gets the microphone.
That's good.
now I've got it. One of the things that you haven't addressed is the fact that I think as a superpower, we sort of get to call the shots and define what is terror. Well, you said that there's a problem with definition, but now that America is a sort of superpower, we get to sort of define it, and sort of forgotten perhaps, and maybe we need to recognize that this country has also sponsored a fair amount of terrorism. A lot of money went to support the IRA in Ireland from this country. The U.S. Supported the Contras in Nicaragua. So, and Savimbi in Angola. I mean, there are many stories of CIA or U.S. sponsored what we call freedom fighters, perhaps, but the states that those freedom fighters were fighting in might have called those people terrorists. And I think, how do we recognize that in this country as well and move forward? People in Iraq may have also defined the war, the attack on Iraq, as a huge act of terrorism.
I think it's very important that we keep all of these ideas and these questions way out in front in our own public debate as to what is appropriate and what is not appropriate in terms of our own use of our of tactics, etc., in the furtherance of our interest. Not all insurgency is terrorism. Indiscriminate killing with respect to bombs that have no particular target, but just who happens to be wherever they happen to be at any particular time. Planes that blow up in the air. I mean, there are a whole set of things that I would define clearly as terrorism. There's always going to be collateral damage as long as there's war. There's a law of war. There's the human rights conventions that cover many other activities. And we international jurists have inevitably to create certain categories, and there are those fine lines and gray areas between those categories. It's hard to often distinguish legitimate, in terms of tactics, legitimate insurgency from terrorism and guerrilla warfare and how that fits in. But I think the best way to keep this system as honest as it can possibly be kept is transparency, to have a good and effective public debate, and to hold those who use those tactics, whether they be our own government or others, accountable to explain and to justify what they've done, and if they've crossed the line, to hold them accountable.
Thank you. I wanted to just follow up on a couple of comments you'd made about changing views of terrorism within countries and perceptions in the Middle East. And I'm wondering if the recent upheavals in several North African and Middle Eastern states, which seem to be largely secular-driven and moving toward some form of more democratic and participatory government, and the Arab League's willingness to endorse sanctions against Libya, which I thought was quite interesting. Are those indications that perhaps both the groups that you mentioned and the states that support them are likely to become increasingly marginalized, or that there may be some more official recognition of the more peaceful and secular approach to development in the Middle East and the harm of these groups and support for them?
I have to say, I looked very often at my own crystal ball, and it is so muddy and vague and cloudy that I don't have the faintest idea of what it is that we can expect that will come from this. I am very hopeful. I would love to see the creation and establishment of democratic institutions in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Syria. But I don't know what's going to happen with them. I think it's too early to tell. There are too many factors at play. This may be good. This may be bad. This may change the whole mindset of a number of these countries. It may marginalize groups like Al-Qaeda. It may end up giving them new places from which they can base their operations and new grounds for recruitment. I don't know. I have to be honest. I don't think we really know yet. And I think that this is also something that has to be looked at very closely and part of our own public debate here in the United States. So I can't answer that question at this time. I'm confused and troubled by it.
It does seem interesting that the Arab League itself would have gone on the record to support an applying strategy in one of
Yes. Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Yes, you're very dismissive of addressing the root causes of the terrorism and seem to be wanting to treat only the symptoms, which seems to be akin to treating a headache when the tumor is a cause of that. Isn't it flawed diplomacy, to use your term, to not address the legitimate grievances like the Israeli occupation and land theft of Palestinians, our support of brutal Arab dictators or imperial wars that seems to be driving the reasons behind terrorism? So shouldn't we stop participating in it if we want to stop it?
I think that we must always keep in mind, for their own sake, the root causes of any misery, of any of these kinds of injustices and problems. I just reject that misery These kinds of issues are justifications for the use of terrorist tactics. I don't reject the notion that we need to be mindful of the problems of the world and of society, and that we need to direct a great number of efforts to bring up the standard of living and the standard of institutions and justice throughout the world. My problem is that I cannot accept the suggestion that because people are poor or they have suffered injustices, that they can hold innocent people who have nothing to do with that accountable by putting a bomb on a bus. I just can't accept that. So that's at least my own personal feeling. I do agree, though, that we must use whatever efforts we can to deal with the societal problems that this world faces today.
It's okay to drop bombs on.
I'm not seeking to justify any actions. I am seeking to condemn very specifically a category of actions that I think needs our universal condemnation. I believe that we should look closely at all of these acts and decide from a series of perspectives, but I don't put them in the same category in my thinking as terrorism. Terrorism is not that I'm creating a hierarchy of different issues. Terrorism is an issue that I'm dealing with. It's a discrete issue that is different from violations of the laws of war, violation of the humanitarian conventions, or otherwise morally unjustified actions or crimes, etc. Those are all problems. They all need to be dealt with. But when I'm addressing terrorism, I try to address that as a discrete issue.
I saw a documentary and people were saying that like there was like less crime when the Taliban were around. So what are we trying to get out of this war if the people don't want us there?
I'm sorry, can you repeat? I didn't quite hear all of the question.
Well, I saw a documentary and then the people on the ground were saying when Taliban is around, there's like less crime because their problems will be solved by the Taliban. So like, why are we in Afghanistan if people don't want us there?
Well, dictators do have a way of dealing with criminals, perhaps that is in the sense of keeping a society crime-free, perhaps effective, using tactics that none of us will agree to. The slightest infractions in the Taliban-controlled parts of Afghanistan usually involve stoning to death. Which I think is a little bit of extreme. It may stop crime for a while, but I don't think it's justified. The Taliban is a terrorist organization that employs the use of terrorist tactics in furtherance of its goal, but it's more than that. It is an organization that clearly violates our own concepts of human rights. Particularly in the areas of, with respect to its lack of tolerance for deviation from its own concepts of Islam, its treatment of other religions, its treatment of women, relegating them literally to slavery within the household. We had an opportunity to see the kind of rule and the kind of administration the Taliban gave to Afghanistan in the period of time when they controlled two-thirds of the country. And I think the world was aghast at that, and it bothered all of our consciences, the way in which they treated their own people and the way in which they administered their laws. So that I hope that answers in part your question.
I'd like to thank Victor Komras for coming all this way. This is his first time to Alaska, and we'd like to entice him to come back again. So we have a book for you of Alaska with some pictures. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And he will be signing his book for all those who are interested right afterwards, so please stick around. Our next program next week will be on Friday when Egyptian-born Ambassador Hussein Hassouna, who is the chief representative of the League of Arab States to the U.S., will speak to us on current challenges facing the Middle East and Arab world perspective. This will be here at the Hilton at 11:30. Please check our website for future programs.